Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Today on the show, we have Alexander Larman, a historian and journalist who has been published in The Observer, The Telegraph, and The Guardian, among other publications. And in addition to many other books, he is the author of a trilogy of books about the Windsors that started with The Crown in Crisis, Countdown to the Abdication in 2021. The Windsors at War, The King, His Brother, and A Family Divided in 2023, and now Power and Glory, Elizabeth II and the Rebirth of Royalty, out April 30th. Alexander, thank you so much for being here today and welcome to the show.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as we said in the introduction, Power and Glory ends the Windsor family trilogy. So this book covers then Princess Elizabeth's landmark 1947 speech in South Africa, the one that listeners always makes me cry. I've never been able to say the speech out loud without getting emotional, on her 21st birthday. And it goes through her engagement, her wedding to Prince Philip, her father, King George VI's death, the discovery of the Duke of Windsor's treacherous activities in World War II, and then to the beginning of the new Elizabethan age. So why choose to close the trilogy with this time period? We were just talking in the pre-show and you said that it kind of felt like that was the natural place to end the trilogy. So why is that?
Well, what happened was that when I sat down to write The Crown in Crisis about 5 or 6 years ago now, I had no intention of writing a trilogy of books. I mean, it wasn't as if I thought to myself, I'm going to write a Windsor trilogy, because anyone who writes a trilogy, I mean, it's a big undertaking. It's going to take up an awful lot of your time, awful lot of effort. And I wanted to tell the story of the abdication crisis, because I thought there hasn't been the definitive book written about it. There's so much more material now than there used to be. That would make for a really interesting book. But when I finished that book, I thought, I can't stop here, because it feels like the first act in something else. There's so much more to talk about. I mean, the book ends on a cliffhanger. It ends on the Duke of Windsor leaving England to go off into exile. Mm-hmm. And if you can't leave it like that, so then the second book, The Windsors at War, was the completion, in a sense, of that part of the story. It's about the relationship between George VI and Edward and his treachery and what happens in World War II. And then I ended that book and I was thinking, I can't stop there either. And so Power and Glory is in a sense, I mean, because what I was worried about when I sat down to research it was, is it going to be an anticlimax compared to the other two? Because Crown and Crisis, you have the abdication crisis. Windsors at War, you have World War II. You think, well, what do you have in this? I mean, what's so impressive and important? And actually, you've outlined quite a lot of what happened in the period covered by the book. And don't forget, there's the atomic bomb as well, landing on Hiroshima. So it's, yes, I mean, you know, you've got speeches, you've got death, you've got treachery, you've got atomic bombs, you've got marriages, you've got a coronation. I mean, it's quite a lot in one book.
Yeah, that's a lot to pack into the trilogy. That's a lot.
And I suppose what I've always tried to do is I've always tried to look at these international events through through the prism of the British royal family and how they reacted to it, I mean, what their innermost thoughts were. So I hope I've done in all three books is that what I enjoy doing is you take the official account of something, you take the account that we're all used to hearing via the history books or via the newspapers or whatever, and then you go into the actual letters and diaries of the people involved in it, and you often see there's a completely different story behind that. Mm-hmm. And something that I've always been very pleased to do is I've been very lucky in that I've had access to the Royal Archives to research all three books in the trilogy, and all the material at the Royal Archives is absolutely invaluable for any historian or any researcher. And what I hope I've done is to bring in a lot of stuff into the public eye that's never been seen before. And I hope that even if you've read 100 books about the royal family, there'll still be stuff in this one that you'll think, I never knew this. Mm-hmm. It'll be a really interesting, really exciting read.
Definitely.
What was it about the period from the abdication to the beginning of Queen Elizabeth's reign that drew you in?
Well, what I find so fascinating about the royal family in this period is that it's a relatively short time. I mean, it's about 17 years you're discussing. The fact that I've written three books about 17 years shows, I mean, and also the books are quite long. I mean, I think it's about 100,000 words in total, but I could easily have written longer books because there is a lot more to say. And occasionally it's quite interesting, so I was going through the documents that I was using for research and I thought, oh, I wish I'd kept that story in, I wish I'd had that detail. But you have to be ruthless, you have to keep absolutely everything pared to the bone. But what I find so interesting about it is it's a time of change. But you look at the royal family when Edward VIII becomes king at the beginning of 1936. And it's emerging from the reign of George V, which was quite an austere reign. I mean, Victorian values, very much the kind of thing that not that different either in terms of time or in terms of attitudes to Queen Victoria. Then you look at the change that comes with Edward, the change that comes with George VI, and then the change that's about to come with Elizabeth II. And you see there is so much in Britain and in the world that is shifting. But you think what you have to do is you have to chronicle not just the events that you're describing, but also how people reacted to them. Because often you see these letters and you see these journals and things that seem to us to have been obvious or that seem to be, you know, massively significant, at the time you can barely notice any of them. And what I also found myself doing was having very strong personal reactions to the people involved in the story. That you, because I suppose any historian or any royal chronicler has this, that you stop thinking of them as these isolated and detached figures. They become almost like characters in a book you're creating. So you start to think of the character of George VI, the character of Princess Elizabeth, and of course, last but very much least, the character of the Duke of Windsor.
He's a character, that's for sure.
Oh, yes.
So does it has to feel bittersweet to have this trilogy over now? And are you done writing royal books? Do you see any more royal books in your future?
Well, there is a book I'm writing, not my next, but my book after next, which is going to be both literally and metaphorically royal adjacent. It's been publicly announced, so I think I can now tell you this, but it's a book about Eaton Square in London, which is just behind Buckingham Palace.
Interesting.
It wasn't a place that any of the royal family actually lived. They were constantly there. So what I'm looking forward to doing is telling the entire history of Eaton Square over about two centuries. So it's not just the modern monarchy, it's the old monarchy as well. So yeah, that's going to be really interesting to explore some of the more scandalous and off-duty aspects of their lives, as well as obviously the official ones. But yes, I mean, it definitely is a bittersweet experience because you have lived with this period, you've lived with the people for so long, but saying goodbye to them, I mean, possibly forever, possibly temporarily, it does feel as if somebody else will come in and write a brilliant book about the subject, or come in and write a brilliant book about what happened before, what happened after, because this is a period that people never get bored of. People always want to discuss it. And that's why I'm always happy to, you know, go to any kind of podcast or any kind of public appearance, because I never get bored talking about it.
Well, speaking of, let's talk about the title of your current book. So is it called Power and Glory because that's what Queen Elizabeth brought back to the monarchy?
The titles are ironic. The whole point of a book is there isn't any power, there isn't much glory. The idea at the end is that Elizabeth has redeemed it, that she actually restores what people expect. But what I wanted to do, I mean, every book of mine is about the monarchy in crisis. First is about the monarchy in crisis because of the abdication. Second is about the monarchy in crisis because the country's at war and the Duke of Windsor's a traitor. This one's about crisis because Britain's won the war, but it's in an absolutely terrible state. You've got this new Labour government with Clement Attlee as Prime Minister, and they're not very receptive to the royal family. So you start to ask the question, as I think George VI was doing, what's the point of us? What are we here for? And so obviously the title's got lots of different resonances. The first thing is it's you know, from the Lord's Prayer, thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory. Mm-hmm. The second is that, yes, it's supposed to be ironic. It's supposed to be about how there isn't any power and there certainly isn't any glory. And then the third part is, yes, I mean, Elizabeth did bring back glory to the monarchy. I mean, I don't think she brought back power. I mean, the power that she conveyed was very much a kind of a power of reputation rather than the power of actually getting anything done. But I hope it's one of those titles that, I mean, those are my interpretations of it anyway, that you have an allusion to a prayer, you have an ironic quality, but also you have that optimistic quality. But I mean, it's always the case. I mean, it's like Windsor's at war. There were supposed to be two quite different meanings of that title. So, you know, it's always one of the most fun parts when you come up with a title for a book. And actually, this one was interesting because having had the alliteration of Crown in Crisis and Windsor's at war, my first idea for this book was the era of Elizabeth. Mm. But then I just thought, that's a bit lame, isn't it? Because it's the kind of thing that if ever I see something like that, my eyes just scan over it. It was Power and Glory. It's got a much more memorable ring to it, I reckon.
No, it does. It packs a punch for sure. And something else that packs a punch is that South Africa speech, which I just will never get over. It's chronicled in the book. You write that after Tommy Lascelles has given the redraft of the speech back to Princess Elizabeth, he was nervous, but she, as you write, finished reading it, looked up at him and said simply, "It has made me cry." So if it made her cry, if it made Princess Elizabeth cry, then okay, I feel a little bit better about it making me cry. And he responded, he was relieved and responded, "Good, for if it makes you cry now, it will make 200 million other people cry when they hear you deliver it, and that is what we want." And he was correct. So countless millions more at that time and since have shared her sentiments, including me, and have gotten emotional at that speech. You write the speech would define her life and subsequent reign and might be the most famous single public statement she ever made. It was simple and hugely powerful. Reaction in Britain to the speech was unanimously positive. Elizabeth's grandmother, Queen Mary, not a woman to give to frivolous displays of emotion, wrote in her diary, "Of course I wept." And the man who would later become her first prime minister, Winston Churchill, had a similar reaction, confessing his deep emotion at the prospect of this young woman one day being queen. It had been a triumph. So what was it about that speech, do you think, as her biographer, that was so poignant? Was it the words? Was it her delivery of it? Was it all of the above? What was it that made that speech so powerful?
Well, you can read it and it makes you cry. So I think that you can always tell that the delivery obviously is very moving as well, but just reading it written down makes you cry. So yes, it's clearly the words. What is it? I think it's twofold, isn't it? It's because it's a statement of purpose and a statement of intent. And she's 21 years old. She knows her father isn't very well. She doesn't know how unwell he is, but she knows that she's going to become queen sooner rather than later. And she knows that ultimately she has this enormous step to take, that by declaring this extraordinary thing, she is going to be making this pact with her future subjects. And that's something that people didn't usually do. Because you have to imagine, I mean, sort of like Edward VIII never did anything like that, and George VI never did anything like that. So it's in a sense, it's saying all my life, whether it be long or short, will be devoted to you and to your service. That's just such, I mean, I find it very, because there are several parts of the book that when I was writing, I found it quite hard to finish writing because I was so emotional. And that's not something I had in Windsor's at War. And it's a bit, I only had it at the end of Crown and Crisis, so that shows you how these things are. But it's a fantastically moving speech, and what's interesting as well is that the original draft was perhaps quite dry, it was perhaps quite factual, and then she worked on it with her parents, and Tommy Lascelles worked on it till it became something which is much more affecting and much more personal. And I think that, yeah, she did very much lead her life by these standards that she outlined. And I think that that's something that will always resonate.
We just passed what would have been the late Queen's 98th birthday on April 21st. She had unmatched dignity, poise, and grace. And I mean, her absence is still felt by so many. Can you tell us a little bit about what made her excel so much in her role as queen?
Well, I think it was several things. I mean, I think that obviously she saw what her father did, and she saw what her uncle did, and she saw that her uncle was a useless king. He was somebody who had no interest or commitments to the throne, and he was just somebody who was pursuing his own interests. And she saw that her father was very dutiful and very committed, but his hatred of public speaking, his hatred of any kind of public events, I mean, he overcame it to an extent during wartime, but he was never truly comfortable being king. So she saw from example what it was not to be king, what it was not to be the monarch. And I think that she came to it with a very simple attitude that her father had instilled in her, which was to be both a human being and to be a monarch. And also so interesting, actually, so over the last few years, we've had the series The Crown. And actually, I think that what has been interesting for me is that of the three actresses who played Elizabeth, Claire Foy was by far the best and by far the one who captured her best. Because I think that what was interesting is that Claire Foy was not a very well-known actress when she took on the role, as both Olivia Colman and Imelda Staunton were very well-known. So it was very hard to forget you were seeing Colman or Staunton on screen. Whereas I think that what we can see about the young queen, as played by Claire Foy, I suspect that performance is a pretty fair representation of what she's like. But she is somebody of great intelligence, of great commitment, who ultimately, if she was doing something out of a sense of duty, she was doing it because she felt that was not just the right thing for her, but the right thing for the country. And I think that's something that we can never forget. We can never forget the idea that the Queen was somebody who reigned for an extraordinarily long time. I mean, she's the longest serving ruler in the history of Britain. And I mean, I can't imagine there will be anybody in our lifetimes or beyond who equals that. And you think about how much the country changed. You think about what Britain was like in 1952, and you think it was like what it was like in 2022. And it is, the world is such a different place in those 70 years. So, I mean, what I made the conscious decision to do, because it's always interesting when you write a book like this, because you don't want to use tricks and you don't want to get all sorts of meta-literary and stuff like that, because you want to tell the story. But what I always knew I was going to do was I was going to end the book with a coronation, but I wanted to stop the story when she walks into Westminster Abbey, because that is where the point of the book ends. But when she walks into Westminster Abbey, it's a different book, it's a different story, and that's somebody else's story to tell. It's about what it was like after she's crowned queen, what it's like, you know, the early years of the reign and so forth. I mean, it's fascinating, but as I said, it's another book, another story. And what I'm hoping is that in the next few years, we're going to see the authorised biography of Elizabeth II, because there'll be, I think, a few years of quiet, and then somebody, and I don't know who it's going to be, will be approached to write it, and they'll be given access to lots of papers. And because she kept a diary, and of course no one's ever seen this diary, and one day somebody will be able to. So it'll be fascinating what is revealed.
Wow, yeah, I would love to see what is in there. I'm not sure I realized. I mean, I guess I could have assumed that she did, but you go on to write in the book, yet at a time when the monarchy in Britain faced existential crisis from both within and without, one speech, no matter how well conceived and delivered, would not be enough to save the institution. Everyone who cared about the royal family looked to a woman in her 20s to safeguard its future. It was an awesome responsibility for anyone, and the fear of those who knew and loved Elizabeth was that she would not be up to it, which, this is me speaking, seems unbelievable knowing what we know now. But again, she was in her mid-20s, and they didn't know that then. Back to you. After all, it would take someone truly remarkable and extraordinary to cope with such a responsibility. Still cometh the hour, cometh the woman. That was a really powerful passage, and I still get goosebumps reading it. But I continue to realize, just as Jessica said earlier, what a remarkable woman She was. So why was she initially so underestimated?
Because she was a young woman with very little experience of the wider world, and you have to remember that during World War II, for her own safety, she was shut up in Windsor Castle for quite a lot of the time. So it isn't until 1945 that she really comes out in both senses. And I mean, it's the fact that she led a very sheltered, very cloistered life. And in fact, one of the things about her marriage to Prince Philip was that there was a sense amongst her family, especially amongst her mother, that she should have had an opportunity to meet more people, to be courted a bit more, that he was the first person that she'd met, and that it was a bad idea, because also Philip was seen as a slightly dubious character. But they fell in love. And I think that what's so nice is that it really was a great love story. And so, but I think, yeah, in terms of her being underestimated, I think that, you know, the attitude towards a queen was very different from the attitude towards a king. It was felt that, is she going to have the stamina? Is she going to be able to take on the demands of a role? I mean, is she going to be like her father? Is she going to be somebody who isn't comfortable with a lot of the pageantry? And of course, the thing is, she just got on with it. And what you can see, reading about her from the perspective of others, is that she was very committed to her work, but she always did it with very good grace. And it's like, it's always funny, because the thing that she said most in her tens of thousands of public appearances and meetings and so forth was, have you come far? And it's such a good question to ask somebody. And of course, in her case, she came extraordinarily far. She had this amazing journey, you know, all over these decades of her life and of her reign. And we see in Power and Glory how it began. Because one thing that I wanted to do in this book, I mean, because in Crown in Crisis, the main focus is on the Duke of Windsor, well, as in Edward VIII back then. Then I deliberately split the focus in Windsor's at War. So you've got the Duke of Windsor and George VI and his family. Whereas in this one, it's three separate focuses. It's Princess Elizabeth and George VI and the Duke of Windsor. And I think it's interesting because the stuff about George VI I find very sad. Stuff about the Duke of Windsor I find shocking. Stuff about Princess Elizabeth I find uplifting and quite optimistic.
I think it's really interesting. You talked about Prince Philip, and your book focuses on the integration of him into the royal family and what he really meant to her. How important was her decision to marry him? And what did her family, specifically King George VI, Queen Elizabeth at the time, and Princess Margaret, feel about Philip marrying into the family?
Oh, there's a long answer to that. I'll try and keep it as brief as possible. It was very much a love match. I mean, they met when she was very young and he was only slightly older. But he was not somebody who was an obvious match for her, because, as somebody once said, if Princess Mary, or if Queen Mary, or if Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, had drawn up a list of possibles as a first 11, Philip would not have been on it. So what you can see is that he was not somebody who was a natural or obvious choice, because he wasn't a member of a leading European royal family. He was somebody who was seen as quite difficult in terms of his personality. I mean, he was a naval captain, which on the one hand, George VI, who was a sailor himself, liked him more because he was felt to be heroic and somebody who'd served at sea. But he wasn't very varnished. I mean, it was known that he'd had quite a lot of flings with girls before he met Princess Elizabeth, and he was somebody who, there was that slight sense of, well, are we doing something a bit dangerous here by bringing him into the royal family? Is he going to know how to behave? And yes, the Queen Mother's brother David hated him with an absolute passion, and a lot of the people like Tommy Lascelles were saying things like, well, he's going to be unfaithful, he's going to go off and do this, you know, he's not somebody we can trust. And what you have to remember is, I mean, what is really interesting, because whenever anyone writes about my books on, you know, Amazon or Goodreads or something like that, I always find it fascinating. If it's a five-star raver or one-star pan, I'm always interested to see what other people say, because sometimes they completely get what you want, what you've been trying to do, and about how, what your intentions are. That's always very gratifying. But I saw one early review that said, oh, Prince Philip emerges badly from this book because he's got these old-fashioned and, you know, very unpleasant views. And I thought, well, yeah, because we see the idea of Philip as somebody who's always given to quite, you know, racially insensitive statements and things like that. But what I was trying to do was to portray another side to him, as somebody who actually was much more intelligent and much more aware and also much more principled than he's often been given credit for. There's a great story, which I was really pleased to include, about when Philip and Elizabeth were getting married, there was a display of all the various wedding presents that they were given. And Mahatma Gandhi sent this tray cloth as a symbol of esteem. And of course, given that relations between India and Britain were not exactly brilliant at this point, it was a kind and generous gesture. And Queen Mary saw this tray cloth and she thought it was Gandhi's loincloth. And she said very loudly, "That's a horrible thing. What a horrible thing to have sent." And Prince Philip said, "No, it isn't a horrible thing at all. I think that Gandhi is a very great man indeed." And she left in angry silence. Mm-hmm. But I find that a very interesting story, because I think it's quite revealing, both about what his actual social and political views were, but also the fact that he was perfectly prepared to stand up to his mother-in-law like that.
Well, I want to talk also, because so much of the first two books feature Wallace and Edward, right? Yeah. They're featured in this book as well. But what, for listeners that haven't read the book yet, what was the role of Wallace and Edward during this time period in this third book? He was writing a memoir, right? And how is his relationship with his niece, Princess Elizabeth, and then who, of course, later becomes Queen Elizabeth?
Well, it's fair to say that they were very much kept at arm's length, because they'd had their purpose in World War II, which was he was the governor of the Bahamas. I mean, Wallace didn't have any kind of purpose, because ultimately she was so hated by the British establishment that keeping her at arm's length was what we wanted to do. And of course, she was never given the HRH title, which Edward wanted her to have more than she did. And this caused no end of difficulty and bother, the fact that she wasn't ever recognised. But obviously, after the war came to an end, I mean, what is so fascinating for me to explore is, what do you do after you've been king? Because, you know, back in the day, of course, if you abdicated, you were likely to be killed by a baron or a lord or something, mm-hmm. because you'd be a dangerous figure. Whereas, of course, you weren't going to be assassinated by some disaffected aristocrat in the 1950s. But instead, yes, Edwards wrote this memoir called A King's Story. And what I wanted to explore was the idea that it was very much edited and very much, I mean, because it was considered absolutely scandalous that a member of the royal family could publish a memoir of his time as king and of the abdication crisis. But what I found really interesting was looking at all the letters going about between courtiers and lawyers and stuff like that, and seeing how much was edited and how much was taken out of it. Because, I mean, obviously, it was considered scandalous in its very existence, but the idea it could have been even more scandalous and even more difficult was quite a revelation.
Well, when Queen Elizabeth took the throne in 1952, what kind of monarchy did she inherit? What were her first days, her months, even her first year like?
Well, I mean, obviously, this is for somebody else to be writing about in more detail, but I think that my attitude in terms of her early reign was that she was taking on an awesome responsibility, and she leant on Philip very heavily as somebody who could obviously provide her with the support that she needed. And Churchill, as her first prime minister, was also invaluable, because even though he was quite advanced in years by then, he was still somebody who could help her, who could be of support to her, and who could give her some indication of how to ground herself in monarchy. Because the thing is that what you can't really imagine before you become king or queen is the sheer amount of work you're going to have to do, because every day you've brought these red boxes, we have to go through them and sign things, otherwise they can't be passed into the law. And you just think to yourself, it's a lot to do, it's a lot of responsibility, and a lot of people would just feel, well, actually, I don't have the aptitude to do this. But of course, Edward VIII famously, I mean, because leaving aside the issue with Wallace, and leaving aside the fact that the marriage he wanted to enter into meant that he wasn't seen as the rightful person to take on the throne, he had absolutely no interest at all in being king. He wanted to be able to lead the same life he led when he was Prince of Wales. And that's a life of self-indulgence. So you can see that Elizabeth was absolutely the opposite, and that her early days, weeks, months would have been stressful, it would have been exhausting, but there also would have been a sense of, right, okay, you get to grips with what the duties involved are, you get to grips with what people expect. And of course, you're meeting your subjects, because she'd done that before as princess. Now she's doing it as queen. But it's a different attitude. I mean, it's the, you know, you take what things, how things are, and certainly Britain, I'm sure America as well. It's that if you have somebody who is a prince or, you know, a senior member of the royal family, there's always an excitement to see them. But if it's the actual king or the actual queen, there's a real veneration. That's quite different, isn't it?
Well, as we close out, I have one more question for you. You talked about readers' reactions to your book. And as this one comes out, and people are reading it and kind of digesting the information, what is something that you really hope that they learn or take away from this sort of end of the trilogy?
Well, what I hope is that you can see it as a trio of journeys, if you like. You can see the Duke of Windsor going from being the Prince of Wales, a man of, you know, who falls in love with Wallace Simpson, who realizes he can't do the duties required from his king and ends up essentially betraying his country and disappearing into obscurity. So that's journey A. For journey B, which is George VI, who actually grows into responsibilities that he has and actually does the best job he can of the circumstances. And then I think the most affecting journey of all is Princess Elizabeth's journey from a young girl who doesn't really have much sense of the wider world, who's led a very cloistered existence, who goes on to be somebody who becomes the greatest monarch that Britain ever had. And if my trilogy has shown these people in their best lights, their worst lights, whatever else, I hope that I've done my job.
This has been a great conversation, and I really enjoyed learning so much about this family from you. Thank you so much for being here. And to our listeners, the third and final book in the Windsor Trilogy, Power and Glory, Elizabeth II and the Rebirth of Royalty, is out as of April 30th. So again, thanks for joining us. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, thank you.
An absolute pleasure for me as well. Thank you so much.